Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Marco Sippi.
On the show today, illustrator and author Nora Kuroko's new graphic novel Heimat asks difficult questions about her family's past and the catastrophic events of the Second World War.
We'll also be hearing from filmmaker Sandy Tan, whose new documentary Shirkers tells the story of a cult classic of Singaporean cinema from the early 1990s that never was. That's now being put right, and we'll be learning why later in the show.
And we'll be hearing the story of Pike Ward, who played a significant role in helping establish the modern nation of Iceland. Heritage specialist and author Catherine Findlay will be discussing her new book.
All that to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll play you some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So there you have it, Marcus. Here we are on the Monocle Weekly.
Yeah, we are again.
Nice to spend a Sunday lunchtime.
Have you noticed with this? You? Have you noticed that there's been a competition in the office, in the editorial floor? There's been a bit of tensions between me and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's been hosting this show with you recently as well.
That's good competition right there.
Yeah.
It's driving quality. Let's get a legend from Midori House into the studio for the Monocle Weekly look ahead. There was something.
Monocle and Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins us
here
in the
he
studio.
Is.
Hey, how are you?
Hello, both.
What have you got for us? Your dress sunshine. Do you have sunshine stories?
Well, perhaps. Shall we start in Toronto? Tomorrow they're voting for a new mayor. And of course, Toronto is a big, important market here for Monocle, for us. I'm sure Thomas will be covering the story quite a lot. The interesting thing, there's not been so many polls recently, but John Tory, the current mayor, apparently, according to the polls, and we shouldn't trust them so much these days, he will win comfortably again. But his candidate, the other candidate, Jennifer Kisnett, she's a former urban planner. We've interviewed her here at Monocle before. She seems quite a good candidate, talking about kind of affordable housing. But apparently she's behind in the polls. So I think John Tory might win this one again.
What else is happening in the course of the next 7 days?
Well, another trade fair in Germany, and we love those, right? It's time for OrgaTech in Cologne. And this one, for those who don't know, is an international trade fair for office design. The first one is 1953, happens every 2 years. And I, for one, would love to be there because, you know, it's huge. You know, I think if you're interested in office design, that's where you should go. So there's an area only for chairs. There's an area only for flooring, which presumes nice floors for your office. I would love to be in the chair section.
Really? I was just going to ask if it would go for floors or chairs.
I think they're very important things. Yeah, but probably the chair section. I think that's massive.
That's where you're spending a huge amount of your time. It's like bedding at home. This is where you're sat all day long.
Exactly.
You've got to look after your backside.
We all have a favorite chair, right? Even here in the office, every time I go on holiday, people steal my chair, but I get it back because I put a secret sticker on it as well.
Clever, Fernando.
But don't give away all your trade secrets, Fernando.
Exactly, exactly.
What else is coming up?
Well, final one, very fun one. On Wednesday, the new biopic of Freddie Mercury is going to be released, Bohemian Rhapsody. I have to say, I'm not the biggest fan of Queen, but those films are profitable. People are loving it because this is the type of film that people go to see not only once, but they go two or even three times.
It's just because everyone loves it. You know, things are a bit tricky. You know, there's some bad stuff going wrong in the world politically at the moment. Do people want that old-fashioned Hollywood escapism? And if there's a bit of a sing-along to boot, all the better. Is that all it is, or is there some other X factor that comes from musical movies?
I think that's the main factor, and also because musicals and horror, funnily enough, they have two very different genres. They're the kind of film that you go to the cinema for. It is different to watch a musical at home or a horror film at home. So people like this kind of shared experience. And especially in this film, Bohemian Rhapsody, everybody will know the lyrics of the most famous songs as well. But, you know, I admire the band. Listen, they were hugely popular. They have a couple of good pop songs as well. So I respect them. That's what I can say about that.
that counts as a compliment of sorts from Fernando, I think. Faye, always good to hear from you. That was our Fernando Augusto Pacheco looking ahead to next week's news today. We shall be back in just a moment hearing from Nora Krug. Don't go away. How How do you understand who you are if you don't understand where you came from? That's the premise of award-winning illustrator and author Nora Krug's new graphic work, Heimat.
The illustrated book looks at the difficult and troubling questions that arise when tracing German history, specifically the country's actions in the Second World War through the context of one's own family tree.
Well, she joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Nora. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on a really beautiful and interesting and compelling book. I wanted to start asking about a thing, I know, a reflection, I suppose, that you've made before on, I guess, why you're telling this story now. And that was your own sense of questioning your own sort of cultural identity, I guess, and how complicated that question is for you. Can you, it's not an easy question, can you give us a sense of why that remain such a sort of enigmatic question that you've wrestled with for such a long time?
Yeah. And the book is both a look back into my own family, trying to find out who my grandparents and other families were and what they did or didn't do under the regime. But it is as much a question of what does German cultural identity mean to me as a German of my generation? And I think it's a question that I've asked myself since my teenage years, because I think to a lot of Germans of my generation, our troubled political past is deeply tied into this question of cultural identity, because the Nazis misappropriated so much of our identity and of our culture. So I grew up in a generation that didn't really celebrate our heritage. We didn't learn old folk songs. We didn't learn the lyrics to our national anthem. We never expressed pride in our culture. And it's a difficult and also quite unhealthy thing, because if you grow up with such a sense of cultural disorientation, how do you know who you are, basically?
Nora, you grew up in southern Germany, in Karlsruhe, right next to a US military airbase. I'm wondering, what was the moment when you were a teenager, when you started asking these questions, for example, about your family's history?
I think that really only began when I learned about the war in school. All my grandparents had died at that point. I think they were all dead by the time I was 8. And I probably learned about the Holocaust around the age of 12 or 13. So that was the very first time that I even considered that my grandparents had been young at one point. You never really think about your grandparents' youth until, you know, you get older. But the learning about the war kind of accelerated that realization for me. And I think that's when I asked questions about their political past for the first time. But my parents knew nothing about that because their own parents had not really talked about it.
Mm. And I just wanted to talk about things that accelerate the process. You obviously then were an expatriate German living in, well, here in the UK and in the United States as well. I wonder whether, maybe counterintuitively, being away was a driver to being more penetrating with those questions. Do you think it enabled you to see things with, well, if not greater clarity, but certainly to ask questions more starkly, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think I would have written the book if I had stayed in Germany. Hannah Arendt once said, where everyone is guilty, no one is. And I think that that's a sentiment that probably many Germans of my generation have, especially those coming from families of so-called followers, so people who were neither major criminals, but also no, you know, war heroes, in quotation marks. So people who are in the middle and were following along, because the sense is, you know, what's there to say about that? If everybody followed along, what questions could I ask? And then when you leave your home country, I mean, that's really true for anybody leaving their country, but as a German in particular, you are certainly confronted much more with how German you are, but also I was confronted with negative stereotypes a lot about Germany, and also with sincere questions about what had happened in my own family. And that's basically when I realized that it had been a taboo all throughout my youth to ask each other, you know, for me to ask my friends, what did your grandparents do, and vice versa. It only hit me that it must have been an unspoken agreement or taboo that we never asked each other.
And actually, in the very first pages of this book, you recall the first time you went to New York and had one of these encounters over there that actually made you think.
Yes, it was an encounter with which I begin the narrative. And I visited a friend of mine in an apartment building on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. And we went upstairs to the rooftop and spoke to each other. And then an elderly woman who was sitting nearby in a lounge chair overheard the conversation and asked me where I was from. And she had heard my accent. And I said, I'm from Germany. And then she went on to tell me that she had been in a concentration camp, and she had survived only because one of the prison guards, female prison guards who worked in the camp, rescued her at the last moment 16 times from the gas chamber. And this was a guard who was extremely violent towards everybody else in the camp, but for some reason had taken a particular liking to her and saved her many times. And this encounter, because of how unexpected it was and because of how intimate in a way it was, because it was just me and her and my friend, it really hit me to the core, and it stayed with me for 16 years. And I actually, just a few months ago, did some more research on Google and was able to find out the name of this woman who I, you know, had met 16 years prior. And so very nervously, I called her up. A friend of mine was able to track down her phone number. And I called her up and very unexpectedly broke out into tears, which has never happened to me in front of a stranger. And then I realized that the reason for that was because she really physically embedded that memory that we had learned about in theory so much in school, but that we had never had a chance to viscerally experience. And here was this woman on the phone again, like 16 years ago, and she was so physically present that it really kind of filled that gap that I had felt all throughout my youth. And then she was very warm, and she invited me to lunch, actually, at her place at the same apartment building that I'd been to 16 years before. And the first time I went over to meet her, she had forgotten the appointment, so she wasn't home. And then she called me on the phone and said, "Will you give me another chance?" And I said, you know, I'm the one who needs the chance, you know. And so we met finally at her place and talked for hours over lunch. And she told me all these stories about how she met people like Josef Mengele. And I mean, this person right in front of you with all these memories embedded physically was just such a powerful experience, and made me realize again how we need to just continue to talk about the past. And
well, there's huge power, searing honesty. And what strikes me as particularly interesting is, again, there's a great, it's something very personal, obviously, about the book and the stories within. And it's rather beautiful. There's an elegiac quality to it. But you're talking about and dealing with some themes that are some of the most challenging in all of human history. You've touched upon that already. This is probably a question you've had repeated to you many times, but why then use this semi-illustrative narrative? I'm sure there are people who said, "Oh, you can't draw pictures about this sort of tale." You know, have people said that? And what's your answer? Because to me, it feels somehow like the perfect way of telling a story. I imagine you agree, but do people have reservations about that?
A few people have told me that they find it more difficult to read than an ordinary book. But I think, I mean, to me, it was such a natural medium. I mean, first of all, I'm an illustrator. So to me, it really represented the way of telling the story. And it's also, I thought a lot about, you know, memory and the memory of war and how it is passed on from generation to generation and how visual our memory is and how fragmented. And I wanted to convey that fragmentary character in this collage feel of the book. And yeah, I don't know why oftentimes we have this idea that historic facts and knowledge should be conveyed in words. I mean, we don't experience it like that. We experience historically lived experienced moments as human beings who see and smell and hear three-dimensionally. We don't experience it in words as we live through them. So why would we only write about it with words? Nobody questions that in films. I mean, nobody asks a documentary filmmaker, "Why did you make a film instead of writing a book?" So I think it's just, to many people, it's still a new medium, visual narrative and nonfiction visual narrative. I mean, there are many people who have used this medium to convey political or social ideas. But to me, it just felt very natural because it's how I perceive the world.
Your book, Heimat, traces back your story, trying to find out the history of your family, what happened in the course of the Second World War. What did you learn? What is your family's story?
So in the book, I focus on two main protagonists. One is my father's brother, who was drafted into the SS as at age 17 and was killed in Italy in combat at age 19. And the other one is my maternal grandfather, who lived in my hometown of Karlsruhe during the war as a driving teacher. And that particular man, I found a U.S. military file at my hometown's archive. And basically anybody living under the U.S. military sector after the war had to fill in a questionnaire that would talk about their engagement or involvement with the Nazi regime during the war years and before. And so it was about 400 and something questions that the form asked. Things like, have you ever bought real estate from a Jewish person? For how much? When? Who can prove it? One of the first questions on the form was, were you a member of the Nazi party? And I saw in his handwriting, because it was the actual original form that he had held in his hands that I dug up, you know, 70 years later, he had written yes. And this came to as a huge shock to me, because he had always told my mother and aunt that he had voted for the Social Democrats, which is basically the Democratic or Liberal Party, and was also the biggest political enemy of the Nazis. So, and only 15% of Germans were members, and I say only in quotation marks, because it wasn't that they didn't want to join, but because the Nazis put a stop on admissions for a while. And so, you know, I asked myself why he joined the party just a few months after he'd voted for the Social Democrats. And then page by page, the file revealed why he had made that decision. And through letters he sent to the military explaining his position, it felt like he was finally talking to me.
Do you feel like you can understand it now with the hindsight, with all of this research and with this deeper... I guess it's a challenge of empathy and sympathy. Do you feel you can understand that process?
Understand, yes. Accept is another thing. I mean, I understand the narrative for why he did it, and I can see how one could feel like one didn't have another choice. But throughout the whole process of my research and sitting at the archive reading through his file, I had these two voices in my head. And I think one maybe represented more my German perspective, and the other one, the American one. And the German one kept on saying, well, you have to understand that he was in a difficult position and he had a family to raise, and you have to, you know, see his human side. And then the American one was always more severe and said, you know, but he was a member in the party and he made himself guilty in a way because, you know, by just joining the party, he had supported the Nazis' ideology. So I felt like there were these two conflicting voices in my head the whole time.
How did all this research change your relations with your family? In the book, you explain how when you grew up, for example, you didn't talk about these things with your parents, but now that you've been doing all this research, you obviously have been talking about that with them as well.
Yes, and I want to clarify that it wasn't that I didn't talk to my parents because they didn't want to talk about it. It was that their own parents didn't talk to them about it, and so they didn't know anything. My parents didn't know anything. And they also didn't have the technological means that I had while doing the research when they were young. So they were actually very, I mean, excited is maybe not the right word, but very eager to find out whatever I found out about their families. And they were supportive from the beginning. I was very lucky in that. I mean, I'm also very close to them.
And I just wonder, to that point as well, especially about the younger generation, if you look politically at Germany now, it's obviously an interesting moment. We have Alternative für Deutschland making some gains. How does that happen? Is that a symptom of parts of the population who are unwilling to ask some of those questions and to be more confrontational, I suppose, with history? Because it does seem... I don't know, it seems extraordinary to me that the country that can produce an illustrator that can make such a beautiful and thoughtful book as this can have that party with their messaging. I don't know, I wonder whether does your understanding, your enhanced understanding contextualise that? Can you sort of make sense of that seeming contradiction almost?
I think there are probably many reasons for why these movements are happening. One is probably globalisation, that people feel threatened in their own understanding of what their cultural identity is. And then, you know, the surge of immigration, you know, a lot of people feel threatened about that. But the problem is, you know, that there are just many ways of confronting these issues. And what they are trying, I mean, what the extreme right is trying to do is they're trying to claim the term Heimat just for themselves as a term that has just one definition that is static, which is unrealistic because, you know, no cultural identity is ever static or has ever been static. We all evolve as societies and have evolved. And so I think one problem in Germany is that the more critically thinking people there still really have a problem loving their country, loving Germany and expressing this love wholeheartedly. And I'm including myself in that. And there seems to be the understanding that you can either only look at your country in a critical light or you can love it but feel, you know, in quotation marks, sick and tired of feeling guilty. And I think Germans should realize that both is possible, that you should be allowed to love your country while still looking back at your history in a critical way. And I think having lived in America for 17 years, I notice also from talking to my friends over there that the opposite is the problem there, that, you know, people feel probably afraid that their love for the United States is threatened when they look more critically and carefully and in depth at slavery or their own family's histories of slavery or, you know, killing Native Americans. And it seems to be difficult for most countries to combine the two, to say, you know, one can only wholeheartedly love one's country if it includes all the difficult time periods that we went through. You know, it's part of our history and we need to look at them all together.
It's incredibly beautiful and affecting book. I think it's fabulous. It should be required reading, not just for Jones. I think people everywhere, we'd all be well served. And I would love to see you turn your pen to the United States, your part home of some years, for a similar project, exactly as you said about this very confused and conflict-filled question about what it is to be American today. Maybe a project for another time? Who knows?
Well, yeah, I thought about that, actually.
Oh, excellent. Well,
now that I'm an American, I have American citizenship, I feel like I can criticize America and look, you know, very carefully at its culture.
Well, I would love to read and view a memoir, a graphic sort of narrative in the same way. I think it's very elegantly done and it's a wonderful book. Nora, thanks for
coming to tell us about it. Thank you so much for having
me. Thank you.
Well, Tom, it's time for some new music now. This is from Berlin-based Swedish pop genius Molly Nilsson. The day is called Days of Dust.
That was Days of Dust by Molly Nilsson. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Pike Ward is a name not well known in the United Kingdom, but the story of how a Devon-born fish merchant helped shape the history of our North Atlantic neighbour Iceland at the turn of the 20th century is a celebrated tale in that country. So much so, in fact, that he was eventually awarded the country's highest honour, the Grand Cross of the Icelandic Falcon.
Following the recent rediscovery of a treasure trove of Ward's photos documenting the Iceland of over a century ago, the journey of this enterprising individual has been compiled for a new book, The Icelandic Adventures of Pike Ward. Earlier Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met the book's editor, Catherine J. Findlay, to learn more.
I'd never heard of him, and it was a complete chance discovery. I was working at the County Archive Service in Devon, where I'm from, but I loved Iceland and I would go to Iceland as much as I possibly could, spend as much time there as I could. And somebody said to me that they thought they had seen some scrapbooks that were from Iceland, knowing that I loved the country. I went exploring and I found them in the stores, and there were 8 photographic scrapbooks that were all called the Icelandic Scrapbook of Pike Ward. And there were 8 of them. And I think they'd been forgotten and they'd been ignored. They were uncatalogued, so nobody would have been able to find them. And I think people thought, oh, they're just somebody's holiday scrapbooks. But I was lucky that I knew the country well enough to know that they weren't holiday scrapbooks. They were something really special. They were obviously made by someone who knew the country intimately, who travelled the whole country. And the images were of ordinary people, everyday life, pictures that I'd never seen before from Iceland. So I contacted the National Museum of Iceland and they were blown away by the photographs. They said, we've never seen images like this from this period. So if that's where it had ended, that would have been a really nice project in itself. I'd found this amazing photograph collection and kind of I'd given the images back to the nation, if you like. Sounds a bit pretentious, but that was really nice in itself. But I had become really intrigued by this person with this very strange name, and I wanted to find out more about him. So I tracked down his family, his descendants, and his great-grandson very kindly let me have access to his diaries from 1906. And they turned out to be very, very entertaining, very insightful. And I began to research in the Icelandic sources about Pikeward. And the more I discovered, the more I realised how important he was and how his story had been completely forgotten, both in this country and for the most part in Iceland. A few historians had heard of him, but for the most part, his name had been forgotten. So it's been a real privilege to restore his reputation.
And he's from Devon like yourself, right?
Yes, he's from Tynmouth, which is a little town on the south coast. And he was from a shipbroking family. So it was a port town. And shipbroking was an important business. So they were a middle-class merchant family, well-to-do. But he was someone with a lot of energy and a lot of curiosity and wanted to get out and see the world. And I think he wanted an adventure. He didn't want to be stuck in a small town all his life.
And why was he so important to Iceland? I mean, besides, you know, the photographs, which we can talk in a bit, which was, I think he was one of the few that took photographs of ordinary people at the time. But he also had new fishing techniques. I mean, tell us a bit how important was he for Iceland?
He was hugely important. He was the first person to pay Icelandic fishermen in cash, which may not sound very revolutionary to us at the kind of end of the 19th century. But fishing in Iceland at that point was really just in its infancy as an industry. And Icelanders at that time were very, very poor. It was a desperately poor country. And most of the merchants were Danish. And they would only barter with Icelandic fishermen for cash, for fish. So Icelanders were trapped. They couldn't better themselves. They had no access to money. And Pike realised that if he paid in cash, he would be benefiting himself, but he would also be benefiting the Icelandic fishermen. And it's really hard to actually overstate how much difference that made to people to have money in their pockets for the first time ever. It meant that people could have choices about their business. They could invest in their business. They could buy bigger boats, could buy equipment. They could demand better prices from Danish merchants. And so that was really what kickstarted what became the Icelandic deep sea trawling industry, which of course is the bedrock of the modern country and the economy. So he was absolutely instrumental in setting Iceland on that path to becoming the modern nation that it is today.
Just give us an idea, at what time was it when Pike went to Iceland? Is it the 19th century or?
Yeah, so it's the end of the 19th century. So he first arrived in 1891 and he stayed until the eve of the First World War. And the significance of that is that it was a really, really pivotal point in Icelandic history. So this is the point where people are agitating for independence from Denmark. Iceland had been ruled by Denmark for hundreds of years. And that was inspired by the kind of nationalist and folklorist movements that were happening right across Europe. People in Iceland began to take a new pride in their culture, in their language, and wanted to be independent. But the problem was it was a tiny population, so only around about 80,000 people, with very few natural resources, very little money, very little to help them kind of stand on their own two feet. So the injection of cash that came from Pikeward was far more than just money. It gave people dignity, it gave people choice, and with that financial independence, political independence then became something that was possible, something that was achievable.
And Catherine, besides your amazing book, which I have to say, I love the retro feel here.
Thank you.
I have a copy in front of me. It does remind me of those kind of novels when you read as a kid, in a way, from the 80s or something. Was that the idea, in a way?
It was, because I think the book works on several different levels. So when I realised that we had a first-hand account, so we had his whole account of 1906, I knew that was going to be really interesting from a historical point of view, because it was a new first-hand account of what was a very, very important period in Icelandic history. But diaries are rarely very readable. other than by the person who wrote them. So they're not usually something that you would want to publish. But when I read them for the first time, I realised just how entertaining they were, how adventurous they were. So it really kind of works as well, just on the level of a great adventure story. So we wanted to go back to that kind of boy's own adventure sort of feel that was, you know, of the time. So that was the look that we were going for with the design there.
And what's your connection with Iceland? Because you are an Icelandophile. Is that the correct
word? That's a word.
That's a word in a way. I mean, do you speak Icelandic?
I don't speak Icelandic. I would love to speak Icelandic, but that is a challenge to learn Icelandic. And it's one of the impressive things about Pike, actually, that he did learn the language. He spoke it fluently. But it is a very difficult language to learn. But that's an ambition for the future for me. But I went there just for a holiday with my son, and we just fell in love with the place and just kept going back and kept going back. And I think for some people, it's the kind of place that just somehow sort of gets you in it. Pike's phrase was that it became something in the blood. That's how he described it. And I knew what he meant when I read that.
Well, and your project is going to be bigger. I think the book is going to be published in Icelandic next year, right?
So it will be released in Iceland in English next year and then in 2020 in Icelandic. But next year at the National Museum of Iceland, there will be an exhibition of his photographs. So the book is available here in the UK now, and then next year in Iceland with this exhibition at the National Museum of Iceland in Reykjavik.
Tell us a bit more about his photographs. What was his kind of style? I mean, did he just went to the country and took pictures of, you know, people in the streets? And tell us a bit more about that.
He's enormously valuable just as a photographer, quite apart from anything else. He was taking the sort of pictures that no one else was taking in Iceland at that time. So he was going out with, he would quite often carry two cameras. So he carried a standard camera, but also a stereo format camera that would take two images next to each other. So that when you print them, they appear 3D. They're absolutely magical. And he would just take his camera wherever he went. And the nature of his business meant that he was travelling the whole country. So it's a rare collection in that it covers the whole country and that it covers ordinary, everyday life. And there were photographers in Iceland at the time. There were some studio photographers in Reykjavik, but very few people out taking pictures of day-to-day life, taking pictures of the landscape. So his value is not as an artistic or technical photographer necessarily, but it's in the social content of those pictures. And what they said to me at the National Museum of Iceland was that there are ways of life shown in those pictures that are not seen in any other Icelandic photographic collection. So ways of life that they knew existed. They knew that's how people lived from written accounts, but they'd never seen them in images before. So that was really exciting. And it's been very interesting, actually, working with the National Museum of Iceland, trying to choose photographs for this exhibition, and their choice of images is very interesting because they're not necessarily the pictures that I might have chosen, because what they're finding interesting is what people are doing in those images. It's not necessarily the prettiest ones. It's the ones that show aspects of life that are maybe surprising, that haven't been seen before.
Will people be able here, perhaps in the UK, to see these pictures at some point as well?
I hope so. I hope that we can bring the exhibition here as well. There is a selection of images in the book. There's really nice quality photo plates, but that was quite difficult to choose because it's such a big collection, such a significant collection, and I just had to choose a small selection. But I hope people enjoy them.
And finally, a little thing about Iceland is fascinating. Like, as you say, when Pike went there, Iceland was a very poor country in a lot of ways, and now it's one of the best quality of life places in the world, fairly wealthy country. I know they had the economic crisis. I mean, what does that say about Iceland in a way?
I think what it says is that, again, this is a very small population. This is people who've really taken that transformation that started to happen at the beginning of the 20th century and really made something of it through sheer kind of determination and self-reliance. And what's interesting is Pike's role in that process and how his money and the way that he did business, which was always very ethical, really just helped to set that ball rolling. And throughout the 20th century, it kept rolling and the country developed at an incredible pace. So development, which had taken hundreds of years in the rest of Europe, happened in a very compressed time frame in Iceland. So it's a very interesting case study of how modernism kind of comes to a country, how a country goes from a sort of almost a medieval way of life to a modern way of life in a very short space of time.
Catherine J. Findlay there speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and the Icelandic Adventures of Pike Ward, edited by K.G. Findlay, is out now. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
In 1992, Singaporean filmmaking hopeful Sandy Tan shot a road movie set across the city-state with her friends Jasmine and Sophie called Shirkers. It combined offbeat influences from the likes of David Lynch with Sandy's own striking vision of the surreal moments found in everyday life to create something truly postmodern. Fans of later Hollywood films like Rushmore or Ghost World might even say Shirkers was somewhat ahead of its time.
But there's a dark twist to the story. Shirkers, which involved months of filmmaking and creativity from its young protagonists, never got finished. In fact, it disappeared for 20 years. That is down to the actions of one man, the unsettling presence of Sandy's filmmaking tutor George Cardona, who stole the reels and disappeared from Singapore.
Today, Shirkers is a documentary tracing the strange tale of the film's creation, its loss, and its re-emergence, soon to air on Netflix. Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Sandy Tan to learn more, but first, here's a clip.
When I was 18, the thing I wanted more than anything was to make a movie. I had the idea that you found freedom by building worlds inside your head. That you had to go backwards in order to go forwards. I was the screenwriter and played the heroine, a 16-year-old killer named S.
Did you feel it was childish?
Yeah, but that was the beauty of it, right?
Our passion and our earnestness came through.
Sophie was the producer. Jasmine was the editor. George was the director.
Were you rolling?
Shirkers became a secret history that would haunt us and bond us forever.
One, two, three.
We shot this on 16, and our fearless leader was this American man who was in his 40s, who was our film instructor. He was going to be the director of the film. In fact, he was, I guess, the de facto director of the film. And we shot this thing with all our friends, 100 locations, 100 extras in Singapore, in the streets of Singapore. And this was amazing, an amazing endeavor that we did this. And then once the whole thing was shot, this man, George, vanished with all the footage. So Shirkers is about me kind of, you know, locating the footage after all these years, like 25 years later, and you know, putting the whole story together again and finding all these people that whose lives were kind of touched and destroyed by it. My friends were no longer my friends, and you know, just solving the big mystery of what happened, and the, you know, putting together the huge jigsaw puzzle that was my life, I guess.
And I mean, as you're watching the film, there's so many sort of different undercurrents of what's going on, but I mean, one of the things that really just struck me was how incredibly industrious you and your two friends were in making this at, you know, age 18, was that right?
Or 18 when we were friends with him. When we made the film, we were about 19. Yeah.
I mean, that is, it's an incredibly, it looks incredible anyway, even today in its current state. You hadn't made a film before. How did you go about sort of pulling this together? Because it's a huge undertaking.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I've been buzzing in my head since I was, I guess, 13 or 14, keeping huge journals and just like writing a million scripts and writing novels that were never published and just like always dreaming of doing things. And I was very, very hyperactive in my mind. So this seemed like a natural extension of that kind of hyperactivity and, you know, pulling my friends along. I was lucky enough to have friends to be pulled along for the ride. And when we were 18, when we did our A-levels, Jasmine and I went to this, you know, special drama program in Singapore at Victoria Junior College, which was like the first drama, theater studies and drama A-level program in the world. I mean, it was like the pilot program for developing the syllabus that's still being in use today. And so we were very slightly ambitious and precocious and encouraged to just reach for the stars always. So when this opportunity to make a film came about, you know, with George, you know, we weren't going to say no. Nobody was making films in Singapore. So when this came about, like, you could just make a film, and there was a grown-up face to it. We could go and speak to other grown-ups and get them to trust us, because who's going to trust 18-year-olds with, you know, free film and free equipment? So, you know, when we had a grown-up face and a front to go about doing this production, we jumped for it.
And, I mean, George as a character, as well, he's a real person, you know, he's not just some sort of fictional villain or anything like that. What's your thoughts on who that man was? He's no longer alive. He seemed to jump from place to place. He seemed to build his life in each of those places on some sort of fictionalized version of himself. And a lot of these actually came from film plots, and you know, and it had very sinister undertones. And yet I guess he did assist you in making this one film. I mean, how do you see that relationship today? Do you is it resentment, or do you have, you know, any affection there still?
Well, it's a very strange thing, because he had enabled my dreams and then he thwarted them. And he's done that to more people than just me. I find him extremely fascinating. I don't see him as a complete villain, even though he's sort of my nemesis in my life and in this film, where he leaves me clues even after his death to be solved almost. We seem to be having this strange conversation, you know, through the chasm, even though he's dead, and we're still having this strange conversation. I find him a very, very strange and compelling friend. You know, I wouldn't say an enemy, but he behaved like an enemy at points. I think he's a fascinating character, a man who kind of creates by destroying and taking away. He's the man who creates by leaving behind black holes through which he would be remembered, I guess, you know, like in the absence, I guess, of like he takes away things that are meaningful to young people, things they worked on. So they remember him as the person who took it away. And there's something very, very dark and sinister about that, but also very, very fascinating. I mean, he operates almost as if he was, you know, a psychopath, or, you know, a kid I talked to after one of my screenings said, oh, he's like a psycho killer, except instead of killing people, he actually stole films. I mean, that's his mode of operation. But he worked certainly like a sociopathic psycho killer who, you know, invented himself. A very classic American type, I feel, even though, well, it's a spoiler here, you know, because he's not actually born in America, but he certainly is an American type, you know, self-created, you know, bits and pieces from made up from different movies. I call him a vampire of cinema, because he seems to absorb like all his like favorite characters, who aren't necessarily, interestingly, not necessarily heroic characters or even admirable characters, but sometimes sinister characters. And he kind of makes he made a composite. Like, he's a composite of all these various movie types. And then that all together formed George Cardona. And I think he's such a movie character. And it's apt that, you know, I've made him a character in my film, I guess.
This film is being released. I mean, we can't not talk about the sort of wider conversation of what's been going on over the past year, specifically where it started in the film business, actually, of, you know, conversations about relationships between men in power and men using their power over sort of younger, influential women. I mean, you must have been making this film since, I guess, before that moment. But I mean, when that moment arrived, I mean, did you feel like it was going to shape the release of the film?
No, not at all. You know, because I feel like it would be too much for me to thrust myself into that kind of narrative, because I wasn't as scarred as many people. Although, you know, in many ways I was, you know, I guess spiritually and psychically and, you know, like my soul was broken, I guess, in some ways, having my work taken away from me and my friends as well. What happened was reading these stories about these things that happened to women that are coming forth, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, people saying, why did it take so long? You know, because people ask me, why now? And all this, you know, it's a very painful thing to relive and think about. And, you know, like, we went through the heartbreak of having our film taken away from us once. And to want to, I don't know, it's like, revisit it. It was a very difficult thing over the years. And, you know, somehow I felt kinship reading about these people's stories and how helpless they felt, because I remember certainly feeling extremely helpless when this was happening and extremely alone, that, you know, nobody would believe me. And also, not only would people not believe me, they would just think I was stupid to have been involved with this, put myself in that position of hanging out with this obviously slightly dodgy-seeming older man, you know, but it didn't seem like we were smart. We went in with our eyes open. We were intelligent women. But somehow the culture was that we would be the ones who would be blamed for putting ourselves in that position. And reading those accounts really made me feel like I was less alone in that. And maybe I shouldn't have been so ashamed and so embarrassed because I, you know, it was not my fault. You know, not our fault. This was such an aberrant incident that no one could have predicted it would happen, or that we should have felt like we should have been more active in pursuing him and getting the thing back, because it was so difficult to find him. And it was so heartbreaking to chase him for more than a year. Like, you just didn't want to keep having this thing be haunting your life forever. And you just, after a while, you learn to let go and just let it move on. And I think a lot of these women in the Me Too movement moved on. And it's only now that they're coming forward, because there are enough people with stories like this that, you know, this has become a thing.
Coming back to the film itself, when you see the footage of it, I mean, I have never been to Singapore. I don't know what it looks like to walk around on the streets there, but just the actual sort of imagery is so striking. The colours are so strong. The cinematography is so good. I mean, this was, as I've said, you guys were 18. It was your first film. How much of that is incredibly intent and deliberate? And then how much of it is just capturing, you know, the images as you film them? How much of that look was created by you guys, and how much of it is just sort of Singapore sort of, you know, singing on the screen?
The interior shots were art directed like crazy and chosen very specifically by us, and, you know, the palettes we had in mind. The external shots, I mean, it was through our lens of like basically my favorite places that I knew were disappearing, that I saw that was special. But George and I, actually George had a really good eye for interesting buildings, and I had a list of all my favorite like crazy places, like all these mannequin shops. I mean, there are so many mannequin shops. None of them exist now, but they're all, you know, all these buildings that look like storybook houses, places from the 50s that I knew wouldn't last forever. And I just thought, you know, we had to capture them. I just wanted to make a film that would make the most boring, tiny city in the world seem almost mythic and almost cinematic on the scale of, say, you know, like some of those road movies we so admired by Wim Wenders, like Paris, Texas. We didn't have the landscape on that scale, but we had other things. And I wanted to somehow collect all of these, you know, faces and places that interested me, that I saw, that I knew about, that, you know, most people in Singapore didn't even notice because they were so concerned with, you know, their grades or making money or being in the city, and just, you know, they're more interested in the kind of the forward-looking skyscraper-esque parts of Singapore in that part. And we didn't have a single skyscraper in our film. It was very a deliberate choice. So we filmed what was there, but we chose what to film. And so it was a very, you know, on the railway tracks were as they were, the buildings were as they were, but it was which buildings we chose. And it was a very, very selective view of Singapore that I wanted to create, to share with the world.
I like that you say it's a road movie about a country that you can cross in 40 minutes, which mm-hmm. is sort of like, I like the sort of the grandness and also the sort of compactness of that statement. It's nicely like sort of self-contained, if you
yeah,
know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in that sort of world-building kind of mentality.
Yeah, know? Yeah. It was, you know, I was really into like dollhouses and creating stories and all these like miniature versions of things. I was, you know, into imaginary worlds. And so I just wanted to kind of, I don't know, like Jasmine would accuse me of, you know, turning everything into my terrarium. But it was like, I just wanted to make the vivid world, because I thought there was so many interesting people, so many interesting places and faces and stories around me. And I just wanted to put them all in this kind of strange Valentine to a place that I was kind of ambivalent about and still am ambivalent about, and in a form that was shareable with not just people in Singapore, but people outside of it, to see that this was not just the tourist brochure. I mean, Singapore was not just that thing. It was actually so much more. And that interesting part of Singapore, the kind of sleepy side, the sleepy, you know, Southeast Asian, jungly Singapore that was quickly disappearing before our eyes. I just knew I had to capture it somehow. And when George, you know, jumped, when he saw my first draft of the script and he said, let's do it. I mean, this is the only adult I knew in around in Singapore who was crazy enough to believe in such a venture and to say, let's just go and do it. Of course, I would jump for it. And we all jumped in.
And one thing that struck me, it was obviously fantastic that you did get the footage back in a sense. But one of the sad parts of that is that the sound was lost. So the whole film that you have left is mute. And there's some scenes there where you go back and you speak to the composer you were working with and, you know, they lay music over it. I guess I was wondering when I was watching it, maybe this could become something else. It could be like, no one makes silent films anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could make a silent film and soundtrack it and just make it into something else. I just wonder whether you have thoughts like that or whether you're like, no, this documentary iteration is enough, because the documentary itself is a great film too, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think the footage probably lives its best life in this form. But on that that said, I think you made the choice of saying a silent film, which would have been my choice, you know, rather than ADRing and dubbing, which would have been, I mean, would be kind of comical and tacky and sort of wrong. You know, and I was talking to a friend who runs the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, and she was also saying, why don't you make it into a silent film with intertitles? And that could be a very interesting venture, and I have thought about it. It's going to require another gargantuan effort and, you know, herding together people who might want to do this with me for almost no money for what might become, you know, maybe a DVD extra at best, you know, that kind of thing. And that would be something I'm definitely thinking about, because I have every screening I go to, every festival, there's always a bunch of young people who come forward and say they volunteer their services to join the Shirkas army and you know, want to help me edit this original back together. It's going to be a huge undertaking, and I'll have to probably be the one to oversee it, because I'm the only one who can read Jasmine's handwriting and all the log sheets and the you know, 700 minutes of things and footage and my scripts, you know, of which, I mean, it exists in fragments and would have to be made sense of. I'm not sure I have the time or the energy right now to deal with it, but maybe a while down the road, certainly, might be a fun thing to do.
While I was watching it in the film, you pick up on the point that later films like Ghost World and Rushmore, obviously they weren't influenced by your film, because your film never mm-hmm. made it out,
yeah.
but they were influenced by similar things and were doing exactly. similar things, like, you know, just a few years later down the line. So your film would have been a precursor, and it would have been influential in that way, I think. I mean, you've gone on to make other films, and you've written a book, I know, and you became a film critic. You've done many other things. But have you found that since people have become heightened and aware of this work,
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, I don't know, do you want to still make new films? Are you getting sort of offers, I guess, from people to make films? Because the clarity of vision of someone making this film at 18 is incredible, I think. I think it's like the thing that you made at that age is just insanely, from what we can see of it,
yeah.
it just looks insanely
yeah.
striking for
yeah.
the era.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, when you see Shirkas, I mean, the fact that Shirkas is also a document of my kind of, you know, rediscovery of my passion and confidence in storytelling. As I'm making the film, I'm kind of like getting more confident, and, you know, from my teenage manic self that I kind of recreated in the beginning of the film, and then I grow up during the film and become a detective and sort of try to solve this puzzle. And in the meanwhile, I'm playing with new aspects of 21st century filmmaking, and in doing so, I, you know, realize this is there's no better job in the world. This is the most fun thing. And of course, yeah, I do want to move on. And I'm, you know, just developing several things.
And we won't give away any spoilers or the ending or anything. But just one thing that, as it ended, I kind of felt it all the way through, really. But I just felt incredibly mixed up by the experience. I couldn't tell whether I left it feeling happy. I was happy I got to see it. And I was happy that everyone came out of it in the places they are. But I couldn't really walk away from it knowing what I felt about it. When you set out to make the documentary, were you aiming for an overall theme sensation? Or are you okay with people walking away being like,
happy, sad?
I don't know what that was, but it was super interesting, you know?
Yeah, I want people to feel whatever they feel. Happy, sad is great. A lot of younger audiences that I've shown it to.
That's a much better way of what I just said in about 4 minutes
yeah.
worth of rambling. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of happy, sad in there.
Yeah, yeah. That's like exactly that. I mean, I love things that are happy, sad. I love melancholy, hilarious. I love the range of emotions, because that's life. I mean, that encompasses everything. If you can kind of evoke that kind of range of feelings, I think you've succeeded. A lot of younger audiences feel that it's very, I don't know, inspiring to them. And they, you know, I've had this bunch of people who've seen it several times, like at different festivals, and they keep coming back to it because it you know, they say that it gives them a sort of high, you know, because it helps them, like it's me kind of telling them to be brave or something. And I'm very gratified by that because I would have loved for somebody to have said that to me when I was, you know, 21 or younger, you know, to just go back and like, just don't give up, you know, on something and just keep going. So yeah, happy, sad, or inspired, all of that. I mean, everything, you know, angry. I've had, you know, like small, meek Canadian women see a screening and just be vibrating with rage and just so angry on my behalf. I mean, loving the film, but just angry at George, but somehow feeling kind of cathartic because it's the getting the anger about the rest of the world out through this film or something. And so it's a whole range of feelings. But as long as I provoke feelings or you know, like have people feel something, I think that's, you know, what the purpose of cinema is for, I guess.
Sandy Tan there, speaking to our own Tom Hall. Shirkers is available on Netflix from this week. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
And, Tom, it's pretty much all now for this edition, edition 485 of the Monocle Weekly.
Shall we thank those behind the glass, Marcus? The programme was produced by Tom Hall and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. We'll be back again at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Marcus Hippie, it's goodbye.
Thanks for listening.